Hello everybody and welcome to this new episode. My name is Sarah and this is Amsterdamers, the podcast that introduces you to amazing women from Amsterdam. Is there something you do or experience every 8 days? Maybe this is how often you see the sun in the Netherlands. Or maybe how often you go to the gym or work from home. Every 8 days. Every 8 days, a woman in the Netherlands is killed by her partner or her ex-partner. Every 8 days in this country, there is a femicide. And until the Netherlands manage to bring structural change on the way, it is going to continue to happen every 8 days. Tessel ten Zwege is an activist and author of several books about gender-based violence and femicide in the Netherlands. She is going to explain to us the dynamics of an abusive relationship, why it is not always easy to leave, what needs to change to prevent femicide, and what friends and family can do to help. Welcome, Tessel ten Zwege. Thanks for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Could you please explain how did you come across the topic of femicide and gender-based violence? You have recently published 2 books about it, and you've also collaborated in a third one. When and how did you decide that this is an important topic for you?
Yeah, exactly. So my first book, my debut, was called Dat zal je nooit toelaten. It translates to You Would Never Allow That. And this book was about my personal experience with an abusive partner. So in the process of, healing from that relationship and writing that first book, I came across the term femicide. Because my relationship ended pretty much, quite safely, actually. Like, I ended the relationship and I never heard from him again. And that's quite unique, actually. I mean, that doesn't happen very often. A lot of violent relationships end in months of stalking, more harassment, and sometimes they even end fatally. They end with femicide. So that's when I came across this subject. And in 2020, I think it was published for the first time in Dutch media that in the Netherlands, every 8 days, a woman is murdered by her partner or ex-partner. So that's when I really came across the topic and I saw it appear in media more frequently. But it was only this year, in September actually, that the term was first discussed in the Tweede Kamer in like national politics. So that's why I wanted to write this book. Like, the term has been around. We know quite a lot about femicide from, academic literature and a lot of experience stories, obviously. But politics have stayed quiet about it for quite a long time.
What were the reactions that you have received on all those books so far? Positive and negative, maybe?
Positive or negative, it's difficult to classify because I have gotten a lot of reactions of people that really liked the book and thought that my books were very helpful, which you would think is positive. But the reason people think the books are helpful is usually because they have similar experiences or because they find the books relatable. And obviously, that makes me very sad to hear that so many women have also had to deal with abusive partners, have also felt really hopeless. And a lot of the reactions I get is that people relate to the shame that I describe in the first book, or they relate to the feeling of being the only one. A lot of people think that they're the only ones to have these relationship issues and, experience them in that way. So these feelings of shame and loneliness, obviously, I don't wish that upon my readers.
I came across the term of femicide a couple of years ago. And since then, I notice this to be around a lot, and maybe it's just because I cannot unsee it anymore, which is probably a good thing. But I notice it a lot in pop culture, in movies. There are so many scenes of sexual violence or crime shows or true crime podcasts, which are very, very popular. Is this something that we have normalized, violence against women? That this is just something that we are used to see these days?
Definitely. I think that violence against women is glamorized in a lot of media. Also, in my own experiences, speaking on these topics, I've been interviewed for numerous podcasts and TV shows and documentary series and stuff. And time again, I found that journalists, even like journalists for serious media, try to retell my story that I tell just to inform people and warn people and turned it into this like sensationalist story. I've even had a TV journalist one time ask me to list all my wounds and all the physical injuries I sustained from the abuse, because he thought that it would make a nice cut for his TV show. I really phrased it that way, And recently I wanted to write a piece on femicide for a women's magazine that I write for quite often. And I wanted to showcase some cases in Dutch media that I felt like, served as maybe examples for how a lot of femicide cases happen, so that readers would be warned, look out for these warning signs. And I handed in the article, and the editor replied back to me saying, like, this is quite a heavy article. I think maybe if we would frame it differently and we would write an introduction about true crime that our readers can devour and enjoy, it would be more palatable, more approachable for our readers. So time and time again, I feel like stories of violence against women are kind of made to be entertainment.
It's interesting that you use the word entertainment because I believe I've seen a post of Damn Honey, the Dutch feminist podcast, and they were responding to an article in Dutch media. And don't quote me on the details, it could be wrong. But I think there was a case of a man who murdered his wife and then afterwards set his house on fire, which I think was accidental and not intentional. But my colleagues from Damn Honey were criticizing the almost funny tone of it, how it was like pushed to the forefront that he accidentally set his house on fire.
Yeah, I know which story you mean. I think it was a cop that murdered his wife. Yeah, I've seen those stories as well. And something that's also interesting in this article that they are criticizing is that there is little to no detail about the murder itself. In fact, they don't even call it a murder. They say family drama, as if some mysterious entity called a family drama has murdered both those people when it was a murder-suicide, very clearly. And also, they quote his colleagues and people that know him saying that he was a lovely and a very approachable and amicable person, which I think is so unnecessary to put in an article about a man who murdered his wife, And this is not unique. You see this in a lot of media reputations of femicide, actually.
And I think it already starts with the wording of domestic violence. There's nothing domestic about this.
Yeah, this is why I use the term intimate partner violence usually, just because it demonstrates how exactly like you said, violence is not domestic, but also partners don't necessarily have to live together for it to be a violent relationship.
You just mentioned every 8 days a woman dies by the hands of her partner in a relationship. Are there other official stats in the Netherlands? Is there anybody who keeps an eye on this?
Well, official stats is quite difficult. The stat of every 8 days comes from Atria, an institute for all things gender and feminism. And yeah, they keep track of the women that are murdered in the Netherlands by their partners or ex-partners. It's approximately 40 women each year. But well, what I just mentioned, politics being very slow on this subject, these statistics have been around since 2020, but only in October this year, so a month ago, the Tweede Kamer, the national politics, have agreed to officially keep track and make sure that there are statistics on femicide, because there haven't been any official numbers up until this year. So it's only they're only they've only agreed on registering femicide just now, actually, which is extremely late compared to other European countries.
I have to say I'm struggling a little bit with this because I understand when you're saying they're slow, but the Istanbul Convention, dear listeners, in case you don't know, this is a convention for of officially recognized by many countries when it comes to violence against women, and it has been around for more than 10 years. So how can they still be so slow? And don't get me wrong, that also goes for my own country and other European countries. The Netherlands are not alone in this, but that doesn't make it any better.
Yeah, so the Netherlands has signed the Istanbul Convention, that's right. But they have actually been called out by Grevio, the commission that sees that countries are actually doing their part in living up to these conventions. They've been called out numerous times on not doing the appropriate work to really do the Istanbul Convention justice. So the Grevio has already filed a couple of reports saying that the Netherlands and their policy is not gender sensitive enough, that they aren't registering enough, and that their policy when it comes to police is too splintered. So police in the Netherlands can kind of like do regionally. They can, they can make sure how to handle things with regional departments. And so, national policy on police handling gender-based violence cases just doesn't exist.
Is this because I feel like I see this a lot? Is this based on the thinking that this is not a structural problem, that these are individual cases between people, that maybe someone was too aggressive or someone was too jealous, and that it was like an individual partnership problem and not a structural problem of gender-based violence?
Yeah, I think you say it really well. I think the Netherlands has an issue with self-image. So I think the Netherlands sees itself as a very progressive and gender equal country. And I think a lot of the times this image of the Netherlands is just incorrect, because there is actually a lot of gender inequality in the Netherlands, not only like financially, but also in the private spheres. And what kind of like comes with that is that the Netherlands is also quite a neoliberal country. So we have this tendency to see issues as people, like social issues, as people's personal responsibility. So, when there is gender-based violence in a family, we will call them a probleemgezin, like a problem family. Or when a woman is battered by her husband, we will say things like, why doesn't she just go away? Or why did she pick him? And this is how you create this sense that gender-based violence are like individual incidents in people's private lives, when I think when it happens every 8 days that a woman is murdered by her partner or ex-partner, we should speak of a structural national problem. Because I don't think you should ask the question, why did this woman choose this man? I think you should ask the question, where does this man get the idea from that he can murder a woman if she wants to leave him, or if she says no, or if she doesn't live up to his expectations of her? I think that's the question we should ask ourselves.
And I also think it's in a lot of cases, depending on the person's private situation, not as easy to leave. There is economic violence. She might be depending on him with her visa status. It's not just like you could just pack up your stuff and leave.
Exactly. This is also why I wrote a chapter in my book, Femicide, about specifically women with what we call afhankelijk verblijfsrecht. So women who are migrants based on a marriage, they get a afhankelijk verblijfsrecht, like a dependent visum, essentially. And in yeah. What we see is that a lot of women, like theoretically, if a woman is battered, she w will have like the legal freedom to leave him. But what we see actually happening in practice is that it isn't so easy. So when a woman is battered by a husband who she's dependent on for a visum, she is likely not to, get in touch with the people who can help her escape and who can actually make her have an independent visa.
Do you think that often state institutions or individuals believe that gender-based violence or femicide is something that happens in lower social classes? Or in a broader sense, just the idea, no, in my bubble, in my world, it doesn't happen. It's always the others.
Definitely. We also call this the culturalisering van geweld, so the culturalization, I would translate it to, of violence, especially when it comes to femicide. There's a tendency to call it honor killings when it happens, for example, within Muslim or Middle Eastern families, and to then ascribe the violence to them being Muslim and or them being, not as assimilated into Dutch culture or even being of a lower income, when white Dutch people with a university degree kill each other, it is seen as an incident, as a private matter. So there's definitely a difference in how media talk about killings when the perpetrator is Muslim, is lower income, is maybe not white, versus when it is a white killer, when it is someone with a university degree.
I recently read, and here comes the German title, Das Ende der Ehe, for those who do speak German. For all the others, the translation is The End of Marriage. It's from a French feminist, Emilia Roig, and I highly, highly recommend it. And she spoke about how we as feminists, we fight gender-based violence or the gender pay gap in public. We demonstrate, we try to create awareness for that. But at the same time, in our own relationships, it often happens that we either do not see or do not want to see certain problems as a result of the patriarchy. That we also see it as what we just spoke about, this problem of two individuals. Do you think that's true?
Yes, I think even I mean, obviously in mainstream feminism, the experience of a certain type of woman is prioritized, right? So a lot of mainstream feminism still kind of centers around white womanhood, university degree womanhood, middle class womanhood, and especially in matters of gender-based violence, there's also this assumption that we all have a similar experience being women when it comes to gender-based violence. And while I agree that most women do experience gender-based violence, this looks so very differently, depending on what your social status is. And I don't think that within feminism we talk about that enough.
From what I understand, abusive relationships never go from 0 to 100. I think if that was the case, most people would probably leave because they recognize the red flags. I think it starts more with one line being crossed, and then that becomes the new normal. And then the next line is being crossed, and that becomes the new normal. Is this what makes it so hard for people to leave, from your perspective?
Yeah, well, we talked about material circumstances, of course. So when your visum depends on your partner, but also when you have children together or things like that, obviously, that are th those are all barriers for being able to leave. But also emotionally, I think what I experienced in my own relationship was just definitely a sense of cognitive dissonance. Like, I was very much in denial for a long time because, well, first of all, I was very ashamed. I thought of myself as this like educated, independent, confident young woman who, had the means to escape. So I was very ashamed that I would was still allowing that, quote unquote. And then when you live within that shame and that kind of like being in denial, whenever your partner does something that's horrible, but then follows it up with being super sweet, complimenting you, apologizing, begging you to stay, it is so much easier and so much more attractive to lie to yourself and be like, okay, it's all going to change now and it's all good and it was just an incident, than to really come to terms with the fact that you're in abusive, but also a dangerous situation. That's very difficult to come to terms with, when obviously you don't want that to be true.
I heard from a colleague of mine who has a friend who is in what I would categorize as an abusive relationship, emotionally abusive for sure. And I think if you really have someone for years and years of marriage that talks to you or speaks to you in the worst possible way, that insults you, that calls you stupid and fat and not worthy of love or anything. Of course, that does something to you. At some point, you do start believing that. And I guess at some point, you're just like, yes, maybe he is right. Maybe I am disgusting. And maybe I should be really, really happy that he puts up with me. Or if he gets aggressive, like, yes, it was my fault because the child was screaming. Or yes, because I burned the food.
Yeah, no, I really, yeah, I recognize that. I think for me, I was also very insecure when I met him at first, but also obviously during that relationship, you get more and more insecure. So that was definitely the case. And on top of that, I was 19 when this happened, and my partner at the time was 25. So whenever I would, bring up a boundary or tell him like, I don't feel good about this, I think something is wrong, he would tell me, well, you're inexperienced, you're very young, you don't have enough relationship experience, and you're too sensitive. And well, when you're so young and when you're in this really difficult and warped power dynamic, it's very difficult to really stand your ground and be like, no, I am right and I'm entitled to feel this way. For me, I just kind of assumed like, oh, he's older, he's been in more relationship, he's probably right and he knows what is normal.
If we have someone in the audience who finds themselves to be in an abusive relationship and you had the chance to speak to them directly, what would you like to say?
I think that something that is very important that I went through and I don't want anybody else to go through is this shame about being in an abusive relationship. It took me a long time to really realize that it's never your fault if somebody else treats you wrong. You're not the one calling for it, you're not the one allowing it. You've never done anything to deserve physical violence. And that's really important to really wrap your head around because I feel like women stay stuck in shame and self-blame, and that keeps them silent. And silence can be lethal in these situations. So definitely don't feel ashamed. Feel free to speak out and call on your friends or your family or your close ones for help because you really deserve it.
That brings me to my next questions. What can our listeners do to help if they know someone who is in an abusive relationship, but maybe is in denial about it or is ashamed to reach out for help proactively?
I think something you should definitely not do is tell your friend or relative to leave their abusive partner. Because the moment someone leaves their abusive partner is the most dangerous part of an abusive relationship, and the victim herself knows best when it is safe for her to leave. So it is not a good idea to tell someone you have to leave your partner now, because maybe you will alienate the victim and she will think, oh, I haven't listened to your advice this time and now you don't want to, you know, help me anymore. So what you could do instead of saying you need to leave right now is offer practical help. For example, saying, hey, whenever you are ready, whenever you feel safe enough to make a move, I can maybe lend you a place to stay, or I can help you find an address where he won't find you, or I can help you get your hands on a prepaid phone so that he doesn't check your messages. Things like that are a lot more helpful.
I think it's important what you're saying about not or trying to not put any pressure on that person. Because if you're insisting that in a hetero relationship, in this case, she leaves him and she's failing to do so from your perspective, she might just think like, okay, and this is just another person that I can't manage to satisfy. This is just another person that I'm not good enough for, which is a very twisted way of thinking, but they might think that actually.
Yeah, very much so. And also a lot of times abusive partners will tell her things like, your friends are trying to keep you away from me. You shouldn't listen to anybody. It's us versus them, you know, things like that. So you just might be feeding into his manipulation if you say things like this. It's really important to go about it in a very sensitive and subtle way.
What are organizations or institutions where people can get help?
So in the Netherlands, there's this organization called FIER, F-I-E-R. And you can chat with them in Dutch or English when you have questions about abusive relationships, how to help your friend or relative, but also how to help yourself if you're in that situation. That you can also call them. I think 24/7, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure they're reachable every moment of the day. And there's another organization that I love a lot, especially thinking about more long-term solutions. They are called Emancipator. And Emancipator is an organization that focuses on men's emancipation. So they coach men on how to practice nonviolent communication. They teach men how to communicate about their feelings without having to use their spouse or partner as, you know, someone they act out on. And I think that organization is really, yeah, hitting the nail on the head when it comes to what the solution is to femicide and partner violence. In the long run, I think it is men who need to emancipate and who need to better themselves to really combat this problem.
I mean, there are obviously a lot of factors when it comes to fighting gender-based violence and femicide, and you just mentioned a very important one. I also think the financial situation of women is extremely important, because from what I understand, a lot of women return into an abusive relationship because they are just financially incapable of paying the rent by themselves. Or they're just completely overwhelmed with the idea of living alone, maybe with children, trying to make their way through bureaucracy. And they would probably decide, okay, the evil that I know is better than the evil that I don't know. So yeah. from your perspective, what are other things that need to be changed structurally?
Yeah, I mean, you're completely right. In the last chapter of my book, I talk about this extensively, because I'm quite frustrated with the way the mainstream feminist movement has been dealing with issues of femicide and partner violence. They are loudly calling for, you know, stricter prison sentences or, you know, more in that kind of solutions. But I don't really feel like these are solutions. I mean, research shows that intimate partner violence happens in times of stress. So poverty and disease and housing situations are very directly linked to intimate partner violence. And therefore, I think perpetrators and families in which partner violence happens should get help and not, you know, a prison sentence or, I think that women's lives should be saved instead of getting revenge.
Fight the
So
symptoms, don't fight the disease.
exactly, yeah. So I'm glad you mentioned this because I feel like partner violence and femicide requires pretty much a socialist approach. Happy people don't abuse people. People who feel safe and secure don't abuse their spouses. Poverty issues, housing issues, things like that, they should be solved before we can see a change in the number of intimate partner violence and femicide cases.
How can people support you and your work?
Well, for the Dutch speakers, you can buy my books. They're called Dat zij je nooit toelaten. Then the second one is called Voorbij de Verbijstering. It's a collection of essays with I put together with Anja Meulebelt and René Rumkens. And then my newest book that came out today, actually, is called Femicide, or Femicide, Tot de Dood Ons Scheidt. I'm really trying to get my first book translated into English. I've been speaking to some indie publishers, so I'll let you know once it is translated. And I also made a web series on online feminism called Tessel in Cyberspace, and it's free to watch on YouTube for everybody. It's got subtitles in English, German, Dutch, whatever language you speak.
What are your plans for the future? What happens next?
Well, I have written three books on violence against women so far, and I feel for now I would really like to give the subject a rest because I feel like I've said so much about it, and now it's time for the world to do something with my insights, but also for myself to to maybe focus more on solutions and activism and positivity than only writing books that try to shout at people how important these problems are to really make a priority. So instead of problematizing, I would like to focus more on the people that are already making a difference and the differences that are already being made. So that's what I'm looking forward to doing in my work, but also maybe healing, because I feel like writing these three books have made me feel powerful and have made me feel confident and accomplished, but they've also been really difficult and kind of like heavy to be knee deep in these topics in my day-to-day life. So I feel like I want to, I guess, indulge myself in some positivity in the next year.
Tessel ten Slege, thank you very much, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Sarah.
And that's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for tuning in and for supporting this podcast. If you want to support Amsterdamers even more, there are several options to do so. You can check out the Amsterdamers Facebook page and leave a review. Depending on which podcast app you are using to listen to this podcast, you can also rate Amsterdamers there with a 5-star review. In Apple Podcasts, for example, it is possible. Of course, you can also follow Amsterdamers on Instagram. In case you would like to give me some feedback, or you know a person that needs to be interviewed for this podcast, you can send me an email. The email address is amsterdamerspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again, and have a great day.